we'd like to put out another newsletter before the semester's over. So if you have any good news, would you pass it on to us? We only print good news. Don't forget that we'll have punch and cookies after Mr. Nelson's finished tonight. And copies of his book, Player, will be on. Beautiful place in the world. I mentioned his first book, it's a collection of short stories called The Tennis Player. His stories have appeared in Michigan Quarterly Review, Transatlantic Review, North American Review, Suwannee Review, Southern Review, and Virginia Quarterly Review, among others. Have you with us tonight, Ken?
I thought I'd read one story from the book, and then see how the time goes. I'm going to read the title story, which is called The Tennis Player. Simple motion made from the shoulder. Left hand holding the ball came to the left knee. As the weight of his body shifted forward over the baseline, Nicky's arm swung upward in an arc. Suddenly the tennis ball appeared against the blue sky like the moon rising. Through years of practice, countless tosses, Nicky saw only the ball. It hung there poised, and in the precise moment before it fell again, the crack of his racket sent it away. Nicky forced himself halfway to the net, but he lunged more than ran. AG sliced the ball back. It came high and long, and Nicky paused a split second trying to decide whether it would go out. It had been too long since he had last played to know by instinct. His pause was his decision, and he let the ball sail. It struck the court just beyond the baseline. Out. He turned a moment in AG's direction, smiled at luck, and then walked back to the fence where the ball had stopped rolling. His smile faded. With a familiar motion, he dribbled the ball from the court onto his racket. He could still do it effortlessly, and no stranger could tell that he had been away. He tossed the ball lightly from the racket face to his left hand and stepped to the baseline left to center. When he was younger, 12 and 13, Nicky had had tennis on the court when the ball would not do as he wished. He cried when somebody cheated him. He remembered that well. He always read the lines honestly himself, and he could not keep other people's falseness from bothering him. Sometimes when he lost on cheating, he broke his racket on the ground, but it was only out of love for the game. That's how he explained it to his father. "You can work out a new one in the store," his father said. "But he cheated," Nicky protested. "2 hours every day," his father answered. "You can still play your tournaments on the weekends." Dressed in a black robe, he moved lights into position for sittings. New cameras inside out, knew every trick of freezing a face into a tedious smile. He knew the smells of chemicals as the faces emerged under cardboard in the trays. The red lights and larger dryers. He knew the faces of women and newlyweds when at last they returned to the store to collect their own images. Hung, and Nicky served the first ball into the tape. The second topspin turned oval in the air, thudded on the court, and bounced high and away to AG's backhand. The return came to his left, and Nicky reached out awkwardly, out of position for such a hard shot. The ball skipped by and stopped short. With that expression, he turned and walked back again to the baseline. AG lobbed his second ball over. Nicky thought of his father saying that the King of Sweden played tennis until he was 80 years old. His own movements came so strangely, dreamlike, as though he were so old. He told himself that he could not expect too much, but the last was an easy ball, one he should never miss. He remembered AG differently. AG had seemed slower when they had played before. He had been more cheerful. Now his friend seemed farther away, not certain anymore. The ball always seemed beyond reach. He started to think of the way AG had lured him out to play. Then he thought, perhaps it had been Carolyn. We all imagine what you've been through, Carolyn had said to them. They had sat on the swing in the warm spring night. Before, they had often sat there. The terrace overlooked a long, wide swath of lawn which extended down in the dark trees in the night. We try to understand as best we can, all of us, but Nikki, you can't close us out. You have to try as well. You have to try to come back to us. He had closed his eyes and had thought then, how did one go about coming back to everything? Yes, he wanted to come back. There was nothing he wished more than to come back into everything just as he had left it, but happier. He had been so tired then. He opened his eyes again to the night. It's just that everyone has not moved at all, and I've moved a great distance, he said. His mind went on, and he spoke as though she would know what he talked about. Suppose, he had said, that I decide to do only one thing my whole life. What happens then? Why, then you become something, she said. He remembered that he could not quite see her eyes as she had said this. At least you started something, she went on, if you make a decision like that. And what if the one thing you decide upon turns out to be without value? Carolyn had looked at him. She stopped the movement of the swing by putting her foot on the ground. For a moment he thought she might be angry at such nonsense, but as she leaned forward into the light from the shadow from the windows of the house, he could see in her eyes that she did not understand. She had never thought of such things. Hers was another world, one of application, restraint, and respect for property. She did not answer his question. Instead, she leaned close to him and put a kiss on his lips. Then her mother came outdoors. Nikki, it's AG on the phone. He wants to play tennis with you. Carolyn got up. Tell him you will, Nikki. I'm too tired. You aren't really too tired. Not really, he thought. Who knew what really meant? He did. He was lying in a place which was not home and wishing you were not as you were and being so lonely with so many people around you. No, he said, I don't want to. This is what I mean, Nikki, she pleaded. You've got to come back to us. In the end, he agreed to play. The first time was over. Nikki dipped the cover over his racket. You can see the shape of the old self, AG said, turning over. Nearly invisible, Nikki said. He sensed AG's hesitance to walk with her. They headed for the clubhouse. Later in the summer, we'll play again, AG said. Nikki remembered the days when they had traveled the state like circus sideshow performers, playing before the crowds. The crowds were never quiet. They cheered losing shots and always expected the favorite to win. No tournaments, Nikki said. That's over. He stopped on the lawn. Carolyn came down from the clubhouse toward them. She looked bright, her blonde hair against the green of the trees. She twirled a daisy nervously in her hands. Everything at club looked perfect, the spacious lawn, the trees, and the big clubhouse, while the rest of the world had to make do. I watched, she said cheerfully. You both played very well. He had looked for her car before they had gone out in the court. She must have come later. Hello, he said, taking. Blonde hair fell to the sides of her face. She turned to AG. He'll soon be playing as well as ever, won't he? She said he would be, he thought, precisely because that was what she was least certain about. He felt like an invalid who had to be walked and talked. They said to him, Nikki, look at the light. He looked at the light. He was sure he had looked at the light. It was a small point. The voices came from their skulls, not from their mouths, as though they were in a cavern. Nikki looked at the light. He was sure he looked at the light, but they kept repeating it. Carolyn looked at home in the clubhouse. I've ordered lunch, she said. They went in. Nikki looked around at the glass. It was an air-conditioned room and it felt cold. There seemed to be glass everywhere. On a table, he saw a stack of magazines. That was what had done it before, and seeing them startled him. Before, he had stopped reading newspapers and watching television and looking at magazines. Mr. Davidson, the club chairman, came over to shake hands. Good to see you back, Nikki, he said. Nikki nodded. It was as though we were back from the war, except that if he had come back from the war, their enthusiasm would not have been guarded. Looked pretty good out there, I must say. Look at the light. The light came from a point in the flashlight. That's fine, Nikki. In the beginning he had seen the light, but then as they had said, fine, he had not. He did not feel himself move. Look at the light again, over here. He did not move. That's very good, Nicky. You're getting much better. Mr. Davidson held onto his hand like an old uncle. I wish it felt good out there, Nicky said. Carolyn moved off with A.G. Nicky, Mr. Davidson said, I have a favor. Carolyn and A.G. had gone off to leave the two of them alone. Maybe it will help you out too, Mr. Davidson went on. Damon, the club pro can't take his lessons in July. He has that clinic in Jennings, and we need somebody to take over the lessons for him for a while. Carolyn was sitting down at a table looking at him. You could see that she knew that what their conversation was about. He saw her mouth moving in pantomime. Say yes. Look at the light now, Nicky, they had said. Looks different now, Nicky had answered. It was still that point of light, but now he could smile when he saw it. It looked very clear. You're going to be home pretty soon. I know. Have you made any plans? Not really. I thought I would stay around for a while. What about tennis? Maybe play a little tennis again and think about what's ahead. It would mean $10 an hour plus the pro shop, Mr. Davidson said. I haven't played at all, Nicky said. You haven't forgotten, Mr. Davidson said, smiling. It's like riding a bicycle. But it's rusty. Well, it's only lessons. It won't be hard for you. He saw Carolyn at the table. Tennis used to be just young days running in the sun. Now it was not. I'm sort of at loose ends, Nicky said. It would help me out. He looked at Carolyn. Good, Mr. Davidson said. Then we're all set. At 8 every morning in July, he was on the court in sneakers, white shorts, and white shirt. The sun burned him. In slow motion, he demonstrated the strokes of the game to children and ladies, forehands with a handshake grip reaching toward the net on the follow-through, backhands with the elbow lock at the moment of impact, serves like throwing the racket over the net without letting go. He watched the awkward movements of the women, the uncontrolled hitting of the children. He listened to them laugh. From the moment he agreed to teach, Nicky began something new with people around him. He had given in to telling people what they wanted to hear. Of course, in the details of the senses, he was scrupulously honest. He did not charge people too much for the lessons, or say that shots were in which were truly out. He just did not tell them everything. He did not tell people what would hurt them. It was easier to omit. I don't mind the work, he said to Carolyn. Really, Nicky? He did not mind the work. It was the feeling he got from it that he could not stand. Sometimes Carolyn came out to meet him for lunch. They sat in the snack room where instances of his former life were hung on the walls, his arm around A.G. after the state finals and other of the sectionals. He looked at his own tedious smiles. You ought to try another tournament, she said once, just for your confidence. Maybe I will, he said. He knew he could not. Here she met a class of young boys. Carolyn loved to watch the children. She sat beyond the fence on a green bench, laughing as the boys ran wildly over the courts. Nicky knew a few would become good if they played, but he could not wait that long. Ball after ball, he hit to weak backhands, making sure the ball bounced to the perfect spot. Watch the ball, he repeated over and over. Rack it back sooner. It's too late when the ball is already there. Carolyn was the only respite, and yet he knew it was she he could never come back to. He spent most evenings with her, sitting and talking idly. He could not tell her he loved her. He believed he loved her without words. She believed he loved her without words, and he let her believe. He decided that at times he did love her, but since it was only at times, he knew he did not. Sometimes they made love. Those were the times that all else faded from his mind, even the terrible light. He knew she wanted no other than him, and he tried to make her see that he had no other than her, for knowing that for him there was no other chance. He peeled the sheets with me. He looked tan behind her hair. Though Carolyn was there in the darkness under him, he did not think of her. He knew that what he did was the worst thing he could do, yet it was all he had and all he could do. He knew it was not so much her, not so much being inside her body. It was simply being inside, lost with someone else, all thought concentrated outward. It was the end of having a thing. It was terrible to have it not last forever, to awake and find the world more pale and less tenable than ever. Always the next day he was back on the court with the children. He tried to vary his method, but it was not his method which lacked. Sometimes his mind wandered to the hospital where he had been it, tucked away from all of them, beyond the vision of all else, the all else of knowing that it was to blame. His mother used to say to him, "Nicky, are you well? You don't look well." "No, I'm not." "You don't look at all well." "What do looks have to do?" Go down to the photography store to read those smiles. He knew that it was his, that his was the equal of any of those terrible expressions. He went on from day to day as if on a tightrope, the fear of falling increasing as the tightrope became looser and looser. The cars, taxis, directions, space flight schedules, discussions, airplanes, motels, counters, colors, money, neon swimming pools, success, government, medicines, advertising, driving him on and on over the loose rope. He stood in one spot on the court, leaning over his basket of tennis balls, throwing, hitting, and talking. Careful watch now follow through. The long summer seemed to be made of the same weather, always hot air and blue sky. The sky seemed to open outward and beyond. Nicky baked to a deep brown, his hair light. Damon did not come back to take over his teaching in August, but it did not matter then. Mr. Davidson asked Nicky whether he would stay on. Nicky accepted. "I'll be glad to," he said. Nicky never began to believe himself, but he knew everyone else inferred from what he said. He was too removed and watched himself too closely. He did not make his world over in the happiness he drifted, not bothering to explain. Toward the end of August, he began to live through the days. It seemed to him like a great eternity, each day adding to the others to make a dark pall like velvet. Each day he thought he would fall, but Carolyn said, "You look so much healthier being out in the sun. You're much more like your old self, Nicky." "I am myself," he said. Look at the light. He could see the point of light, but he could not move. "Do you think you might try a tournament, just a small one?" "I think I might," Nicky said. "We'll wait and see when it comes up." He often told Carolyn that he would be delayed at the club and they could not come over to her place until later. This was true, but not for the reason he knew she would believe. She would think that he had a late lesson or that the accounting of the shop had, but it was not for those reasons or for any other that he imagined she would see. It was only that he wanted to be alone after the club was empty. The club was a perfect place. In the evening, the courts were no longer sprayed with tennis balls. He did not have to watch shouting children as they raced after the balls. He did not have to say anything to anyone. The club grounds were so peaceful and dark green. The air was filled with the sounds of crickets and breezes, dusk came slowly. One evening in late August, he stayed after lessons. He lay stretched out on the grass beside the courts. He stared through the sky, watching the light blue fade darker toward violet. Trees above him wavered and turned slowly to darkness. Stars began. He loved watching the sky, imagining how deep it was and how it was filled up with space. His loose rope hung over that space. It seemed to him that it would be peaceful that fall, going through the space of the sky. The world moved through several hours. This piece of motor sounded so far down the gravel drive. The headlights of the car struck the leaves over his head, breaking the trees into shadows. The car moved down toward the clubhouse. He sat up. The car turned into the parking lot. The beams moved across his white tennis clothes. He recognized the car as Carolyn's. The door slammed and he lay back. Her footsteps across the grass drowned up the other sounds. "What are you doing still here?" she asked. "I thought you had to go home tonight." "I told you my mother asked me to come." "But you didn't go." "No. I just called there and your mother said they hadn't seen you. We thought something might have happened." She sat down on the grass beside him, folding her dress under him. "You didn't come to me either." "I've been here lying on the grass," he said. He always started to tell her how the sky seemed to go on forever, not just in imaginable time, but in a way he could not even imagine, just deeper and deeper. Instead, he said, "I would have come by to see you later." "When you weren't home, I was worried," Carolyn said to you. He could not see her eyes. He thought that whenever it was important to see her eyes, they were sitting in the dark. Something new was in her voice. Nicky turned on his side toward her. The sun from the day still swarmed in his skin. His leg felt numb and heavy. He didn't want to think about what it might be, but she had to tell him. He started to reach out and touch her. AG called and said, "I should talk to you about the tournament coming up," she said. "He thinks it might bring you back." He knew it was not what she had come to say. "What about my lesson?" "It's just a tournament in the city, a small one." "I mean, my lessons were supposed to bring me back too," Nikki said. "You are back, but you don't want to go on giving tennis lessons forever. You're a top player, lessons aren't in you, but this is, Nikki, please." All he could think of was falling through that endless dark space. "Okay," he said. That space, he reached for her and began stroking her bare arm. He heard her breath start and looked closer to her. "I want to hear what she had to tell him." Nikki began hitting with AG for an hour and a half every day. Carolyn had signed up for an hour lesson right before lunch and gave up her time for their practice. Nikki took a half hour of his own. AG was good to him. Nikki started off riveted at the same spot on the court as though it were a lesson. He could not adjust to AG's hard shots. "I can't," Nikki whispered over and over. He made countless mistakes. He no longer watched the ball, but instead hit out a forgotten skill. He did just what he belabored in lessons to his students. AG encouraged him and took it all. After 2 weeks of practice, Nikki began to see the signs. His legs felt more elastic. His instincts improved. He knew where the ball would come. He started following his serve to the net with a series of quick steps. The serve itself, he whittled deeper and deeper into the service court, a little closer to the corners. Carolyn also came to watch. "See the improvement from day to day," she said when they had come to the court. "I see the improvement," AG joined in, wiping the sweat from his face. "I don't think the lessons have hurt you. You were only lazy." Nikki smiled. He knew it was coming back. He felt the old solid stroke of the racket when he hit. He was trying shots that had been dormant for a year and a half, short topspin, cross courts, drop shots, backhand volleys to the deep corners. They had begun to fall. Even his mood during lessons picked up. He was less bored and more enthusiastic about the game. Weight always forward, he urged. Step into the ball, never backward. Only one thing held him back. Every day she was there, not pressing him in any way, but there. She seemed to hang close to him, always at his side, and yet she did not have the same cheer in her. She seemed wary of everything he said. "Tell me the truth now, Nikki," she said. "What are you doing tonight?" "I am telling the truth," he said. "You're not planning it." "No, why are you like that?" "Because of my..." He had thought about his omissions. "No," she said. "Look, I only wanted to isolate myself," he said. "I had to be alone because then I'm not lying to anyone." "You don't have to explain anything," she said. "I understand." "You don't understand. It wasn't only you." "Now look here at the light. Over here." The point of light seemed very far away. The voices came from space. Tried to move. "So you're back, Nikki. What happened out there? Look at the light." "Now you think your life has purpose again." Carolyn looked at him closely. You could see that her eyes were ready to cry. "You said yourself that I had to start somewhere with one thing." He knew tennis was not it. Then the tears came. Nikki could see no reason, but he knew the reasons were not often seen. She rushed up to him and put her arms around him and held him. It was the way he often held her, except that he could never cry. Before every tournament match in the old days, Nikki had a ritual. He would sit by himself for a half an hour in some quiet place to concentrate. He would hold his fist tightly closed for a minute at a time, pounding them slowly and soundlessly against his knees. He would tell himself to watch the ball and to hit hard without being nervous. Tried to relax, and he told himself that if he got behind, he should change his strategy. Before each serve, he had to bounce the ball 3 times for luck, and if he were winning, he should never think he had won until the last point was played. The hour before this tournament, Nikki knew he was not in the old days. As before, he went off by himself, but he did not think about relaxing or about any of the other things. He had been with Carolyn the night before. She had been quiet, sitting there in the swing. From the step where he sat, he could look down the pathway and listen to the crickets. "Come sit with you," he said. He had not moved. I could sense in her voice that it was finally coming. "What do you have to tell me?" she asked. He asked. In a suddenness he had not expected, the words broke from her. "A child, Nikki, a child." And for a long time he sat listening to the darkness. He saw himself growing dimmer and dimmer, like the fireflies far away in the lawn, and he had gotten up and started walking out toward the dark trees. Later, sometime during their lovemaking, he had told her that he loved her. It was not any kind of omission. He knew he had had to say it. He could not stand the dishonesty, but there was no chance anymore to come back. Look at the light, you know, Nikki. He did not see a light. What was it, Nikki? He could not feel himself move. The light is over here. What was it? He did not speak. The space seemed to close around him. Look at the lies, Nikki. He did not see anything. He took his rackets out to the court. In the warm-up, he hit the ball as if he were concentrating. He knew his opponent from the years before, and Nikki was certain to win easily. He moved mechanically around the court, reacting without thinking. Nikki took 8 practice serves. Then he stepped up to the line and bounced the ball 3 times. It was his old lucky way. Then he leaned back and pointed his racket toward the net. A simple motion from the shoulder. The left hand holding the ball came to the left knee. As the weight of his body shifted forward over the baseline, Nikki's arm swung upward in an arc. Suddenly the tennis ball appeared against the sky like a moon rising. Years of practice and countless tosses had taught him. But now the ball seemed to disappear before his eyes, and all he saw was a wide, deep expanse of space. The flat plain before the mountains is a wide cover of blowing snow. On the plowed road, the snow swirls like dust. The stark white of the snowdrift passes quickly out my side window. Today is cold sun. A black Volvo passes me going about 80 on the street. 3 pairs of skis stripe the roof, undersides blue and orange. Denver license. The man in the back seat takes a long look at Ellen beside me. She smiles, not at him, but at me. I look ahead at the snow, which is blown up by the Volvo. It curls, then rests. I imagine photographing the patterns as I once had with sand dunes. My equipment is in the back of the car. Before I slow down, a new gust of wind has swept away the pattern. At Hartzell, the middle of the plain, we slow down. Another 60 miles to ski. I drive slowly past the 6 or 7 buildings in the town. The Volvo has stopped for gas. 2 young men dressed in colorful wool sweaters stand beside the gas pump while the woman goes inside. "Do you think they're going to bail?" Ellen asks. "Don't know," I say. The unnecessary question breaks the silence we have been riding in. "How should I know?" Ellen looks at me with dark eyes. I do not mean to be short with her. I mean something else which I cannot tell her. Outside the town, we turn onto Route 9, a small road that curves up along the edge of the mountain. The ranches along the road look bound up in snow for the winter. I wonder how the people survive. The Volvo appears again in the rearview mirror. Its silver chrome bumper seems to rush at us. Again it passes, turning up the snow. The man in the back looks Ellen over once again. I try to see her expression, but she looks the other way, not following the Volvo as it races around the curve. "He likes you," I say. She smiles, taking it as a compliment. A smile broadens her face. She looks fine with her hair pulled back. Her eyes seem pleased. "Should I pull up to them?" I ask. Her smile continues. "No. I press my foot down on the accelerator. The VW picks up speed slowly. I leave my foot down. Please, Ellen says, but I leave it down. It seems to me as though we are suspended in the moving car like water at the tips of icicles, not knowing whether we shall freeze or fall. I slow for an unbanked right curve, trying to hug the hill. The VW is too light and it slides out toward the left. I let up on the accelerator and pump the brake. A burst of sun hits from behind the hill. The recognition of something on the road strikes me before it does Ellen. I press hard on the brakes. Ellen jerks forward. She grabs the dash in time. I hold hard on the wheel. Space seems to evaporate between us and the unmoving, shattered cars on the road. To the left of the wreck is a space to squeeze through. The black Volvo lies crushed against the Pontiac. Steam rises from the two engines into the cold air. The Volvo's horn is stuck, and its tone changes as we inch by. Steel mashed and slanted skyward, hood crushed, skis ripped apart, glass shattered. Someone stirs in the Pontiac, but no one in the Volvo moves. The driver's head is wedged between the door and the body. The woman lies over the hood. Ellen's friend in the back seat sits with head bent forward. I pull my sunglasses up onto my knitted cap. From the top of the mountain of Vale, the earth spreads out like a white apron covering a lap. Pockets of dark towns far below are folded into the pieces of the apron. Over the valley, the skyline is only in all mountains. I begin to believe I am not mortal. The morning's accident is in the past. I am a bird which can fly the length and breadth. In the anticipation of my flight, I know no bounds. Convictions, not thoughts, are in my mind. Born the certainty that lives are hollow when two people are no longer of use to one another. I am thinking of Ellen. I pull the glasses into place again. The sky turns yellow-blue. The straps of the ski poles fit tightly around the backs of my wrists. With leg and pole together, I push away from my perch. Impetus delivered, I glide. To my right, the mountain drops off precipitously to a basin below. I dig the edge of the ski inward and lean outward over the hill. The snow hisses beneath me. Whatever I need, I have learned long ago and do not think about. Weight farther back in the powder, tuck and lift up. It is not like other things. I stop. Down in the folds of the valley, Ellen skis easier terrain. She is foolishly afraid to ski here with me, and I am foolishly afraid to ski there with her. Where I stand, the mountain cuts off the wind. In the quiet, I pick out a cloud and watch it move across the mountains. The clouds are scarce today. It reminds me how lazy I am. I cannot muster my strength to hold on to people. It would seem that such a lazy person would content himself to hold on to one. Without thinking, the weight moves. It seems that I barely make contact with the smooth snow. Pole and spring up, I angle cross-country toward the manicured trail. I hurry as though I have seen something to be afraid of. I am making a run for it. Full speed, I hit a drop-off. It looked to me like the one white apron. In the air, my body sinks quickly, though my mind seems to wait. I lurch and lose balance. I feel my poles flip out underneath and the skis drag through the air. A tip catches and I snap forward, arms outstretched. The first puff of snow hits my glasses. I feel the binding snap open. It is the second impact, the bounce from the pain sticking my knee. I have been drinking solid scotches for almost an hour and have limped back and forth to the bathroom. Ellen has gone to the room to rest and I wait for her. A stranger notices my cast. Today, he asks, pointing. He has on a gray sweater, lighter than his hair, baggy pants and slippers. I nod and he smiles. Broken? His questions in one word bother me for no reason. There are pouches under his eyes which make him look torn ligaments. Could have been worse, he says. I could have been dead, I say. I think of the accident that morning, the lightness in my tone frightens me. He begins to tell a life story, how he got where he got. Ellen comes in, sleepy-eyed from a nap. The man spends a long time looking at her. Profession, he asks me. Freelance photographer, travel, fashion, on the scene things, almost whatever I can get. I don't like the press, he says. He goes on thinking aloud that the press has sponsored the war and the riots and the divisions in the country. I keep sipping my scotch as he starts to rave. I can feel Ellen take my arm as though she knows what's coming into my head. I listen. The room begins to wave like heat over a radiator. Come on, let's go, Ellen whispers to me. I stand up and continue to listen and listen until I'm not hearing words anymore, but only the hammering in my head. It is the puffy skin under his eyes that keeps coming to mind. Please, Ellen says. He's calling the press people liars and opportunists of the worst sort. Hey, I shout. He looks at me and stops talking. For the first time he really sees me. I can tell by his eyes. My fist rushes forward from the chest and connects just to the right of his nose and a little above the mouth. I miss the sacks under his eyes. I reach down and take Ellen's hand away. I've been drinking too much, I say. The voice seems to come disembodied from the air. I open my eyes and almost expect to see the voice, but it is only the darkness of the room. Ellen puts her head on my chest and rests her hands there too. The warmth seems so genuine that I cannot disbelieve it. What are you thinking, she asks. Nothing. I wonder in the silence whether anyone can think nothing. Ellen moves. Sometimes you shut me out so tightly, she says. He's up in the bed in the dark, and her nakedness moving away as our nakedness together. She doesn't cry. We had met 3 months before on one of my assignments to photograph a new exhibit she had arranged for a fine art center. I see her there as though in a photograph, brilliant dark hair, dark eyes, yellow dress, though now the light is gone. Lying one night on the picnic blanket, at first she said no, she seemed to be the one with too much to lose. It had grown darker, and in the dust of the world it seemed to dissolve in the dust around us. In timeless, she said yes, because it no longer mattered what she lost. She could not help it. I remember still her short hair then, and her wide-lipped mouth, and later her hand shaking as she bent over her cigarette. The sheets rustle as she turns to me again. There must be some other way for us to go on, she says. When it's like this, I don't know where I stand. I don't know where I stand either. With me, you know. I cannot answer. I'm running away. As I run, I try to grasp one thing and then another to hold on to them for just a moment of time to give me support, but I can hold nothing. It is painful to have everything slip just beyond my reach, but after a while, pain is no different than the absence of pain. Finally, I say, with me, you know, too. We lie together a long time and return to familiar warmth and sleeping. I hear her breath and at last edge away from touching her. In the middle of the night, I wake and turn to her. She does not resist, but eases over in the bed. Connection of the most superficial sort, almost like a glance. That realization sends me running again, mindless, with the white snow rushing past me, my legs burning in the darkness, the silence broken by Ellen's whine. And it happens suddenly, at last, the running slows, I breathe again, sad to come. Incidents. My first memory of particles was one afternoon as a child when the sun chast came into my room through the windows. The light illuminated millions of particles of dust floating in the air. I could sweep my hands at the shaft of light stirring the particles, but always they returned to floating again, even out of the light, according to the currents of the air. One moment I could see them, and the next they had passed the border of light into the shadow and disappeared. The instant of a shudder, the sand dunes, the pattern of snow curls on the road, the film freezing and moving particles. Beyond the shudder, the particles of light continue to move. The bird in flight continues to soar. I have often sat alone in my dark room, hanging the instance along a wire. I have divided light into moments, particles of separated time. At what point does the heart begin to flutter in the womb? I have at times stood the day full of negatives for hours, wondering what I have done to myself. Is sleep coming on me? A few minutes have passed since Ellen and I have made love. I drift in that moment before sleep like the particles of dust through the sun shaft of light in my room, not knowing even whether I am in the sun. or in the shadow. Called The Time and Manner, and put it by a quote. I'll read the quote from James Joyce, Portrait of the Artist of the Museum. Death is certain, the time and manner are uncertain, whether from long disease or from some unexpected accident. The Son of God cometh at an hour when you little expect him. Be therefore ready every moment, seeing that you may die at any moment. The zebra came out from the shade of the trees and onto the short grass of the plain. Sensing no danger, it did not hurry, but rather moved with deliberate ease like a sturdy horse crossing a pasture to the trough. In any animal, there is a majesty of being within the encompassing dark force of life and beauty, and the zebra's hard black and white patterned body stood out on that immense plain the way the bright plumage of a bird might flash to the eye of his perch. For miles around, nothing could be seen except the grass, a few trees, and the sweep of space. The plain seemed empty then, except for the zebra and the two men who crouched with their rifles and the scrap of brush. Through the hazy glass of a crosshaired scope, Elliot noticed that the zebra looked different from the way it did to the naked eye. It was not just the magnification. The animal seemed somehow more finite, closed within that circular black border which blocked out the rest of the plain from its vision. Elliot squinted as he gauged the shot. Then, without lowering the gun, he turned to the man beside him. They confronted each other in a silent question, as though asking for a final time whether they wanted to go through with it. Bradley was a man of few words. He spoke with his eyes. All the lines of his face seemed to run to the sunken eye pockets in which his needle-sharp blue eyes were set off against darkly tanned skin. On this occasion, he said neither yes nor no. Apparently, he believed that the decision had been taken some time long in the back room in New York. Bradley turned away and looked back out toward the plain. Elliot peered again through the scope, his excitement mounting. The heat shimmered up from the dry ground, and there was no breeze to carry a scent. More than anything, he wanted to wipe away the sweat that had suddenly risen on his forehead, but he could not risk the movement. He seemed like a fine specimen. Elliot used that word in his mind. And after coming all the way from there to here, how could he be expected to do other than what he had come to do? The zebra's magnified body rippled in the heat. He had come for the money. A single report. Even before he lowered the rifle, Elliot could see the blood flowing from the wound in the neck. Behind the zebra, other animals he had not noticed began to run, bounding white-assed toward the hills or back to the east toward the trees. The zebra would have run too, but it could not run now. It seemed riveted there, wanting to run, but staring in mindless terror, as if knowing it must face the enemy on behalf of the other. Bradley came up out of the brush. He hadn't liked the business from the beginning, and now it had started in earnest. He seemed to want to get it over with quickly. Elliot stood up too and wiped the sweat from his face. The shot had been good. There was nothing to be tracked farther, and he was glad of that. He didn't know whether Bradley could have taken it. He put the rifle down beside his pack and came out. The zebra tottered and lurched forward, going down on its forelegs and coughing blood. Elliot watched Bradley start to run across the dusty ground to the animal. He didn't know what the hurry was. From the beginning, it had been a simple business deal negotiated in various offices in New York. Elliot had been sent to bring back skins. Bradley had come in later in Nairobi because he supposedly knew the country and the way the wardens worked. He's been in a war, Bradley said when Elliot finally got to the animal. The hide was full of nicks and cuts, little gouges that Elliot had not been able to see through the scope. Across the side of the face was a bad scar, a bleached out patch of flake about 2 inches wide, extending from just below the eye to the bridge of the nose. Elliot had not seen that either. It had been on the zebra's dark side, the side of the moon that was never visible. That kind of scar on the face of a man would have ruined the man's life. He'll be all right. Bradley held out the heavy knife. You want to work on it? Elliot took the knife almost as a reaction. Because I shot, he asked. You know how, Bradley answered. He didn't want to argue. Elliot bent down and dug the knife into the hide of the neck, broke through and started to split the belly. He tried not to go too deep so the blood would not get on the hide. You can pull back as I work, Elliot told him. Hold on and pull toward the backbone. Bradley's hands were shaking as he leaned down over the carcass. Elliot smiled. Bradley wasn't used to death, he thought. The tracking and the waiting had been worth the moment that Bradley had to get down over the open carcass and smell the warm inside. All those expressionless hours camping on the reserve, holding back every detail of his own life, while Elliot talked into the fire about what he'd been through to raise enough money to get along. Bradley could have cased a bank, Elliot thought, but the act itself, that was another matter. He wouldn't shoot. Elliot had to do that, and now he wouldn't skin. Elliot cut slowly, drawing out the time. He knew the shot had made noise, and that you could never tell who might be in the area, but they had scattered the whole district. For cover, they had good cameras in the packs if they were needed. Elliot wasn't nervous about time. Just hold the thing back, Elliot ordered. He cut in expert strokes at the membrane just between the skin and the underlying layer of fat and muscle. He knew his work. Until a few years before, he had guided for trophies in Canada. Some bad things had got around. And those things had ruined his references. The business had dissipated almost overnight. In a messy affair, he'd lost his license and he was through. But now he had a new calling. He worked in silence until the job was done. The zebra's carcass was a mass of fat and blood, and without the patterned black and white hide, the animal seemed nameless. Elliot stood up and stuffed the hide into a plastic bag and handed it to Bradley. The plain had been white moon of life now, and the sky seemed low and even. Both land and sky were empty all the way to the low rising hills in the distance. Elliot wiped his face on a handkerchief. He had worked hard, and there was still more to do once they got back to the rover. They had to scrape the fat and put a solution on it so that it wouldn't rot or harden up. Bradley could do that. He walked back to the brush and got the rifles and packs. Bradley still had the nervousness about him and hurried to collect things. Elliot took a drink of whiskey and washed it down with water from the canteen. It's all right, Elliot told him, offering the whiskey. Bradley refused. They had left the rover about 2 miles back, farther than Elliot had thought reasonable, but he had wanted to avoid arguments. Now they had to walk back. It was just after 4 p.m, still plenty of light. It took only a few minutes to get back through the brush and begin climbing the open part of the gully which led to the ridge. Bradley went first. He had an awkward way of walking on the slope, as though he were pulling his legs behind him rather than stepping. His pace was more rapid now than it had been when he had come down. Elliot watched him and decided to say nothing. About halfway up the hill, Bradley stopped. Elliot was ready to rest. He took another shot of the whiskey. Bradley was looking back toward the carcass lying abandoned in the slanting rays of the sun. It seemed small now from their height and distance with a huge empty plain surrounding them. Then suddenly, Bradley raised his arm and pointed. Elliot followed the upraised arm but saw nothing. Bradley hadn't moved. With his head lifted, his face was as motionless as Elliot had ever seen it. What is it? But just as he asked the question, he saw it himself. In the endless blue waste, a black speck floated. Like a piece of dust caught close in the room, or like an insect whirling, depending upon the distance. If the speck was high up, distance measured only by its being nearly invisible. Elliot raised the rifle and focused the scope. The zebra had not been dead over 40 minutes. Elliot lowered the rifle again. The black multiplied, 3, 4 of them. They were distinct shapes now, with wings angled back, gliding in a direct line. Elliot turned full circle. He knew this was what happened at death, but he had never thought how they came in. He thought they always circled for a long time, waiting perhaps for the rot. they were coming straight in across the open plain. Deaths in families and accidents he read about in newspapers never allowed for vultures. He thought more of antiseptics and had a certain detachment of death from his own life. He imagined it embalming. Even in Canada, when he was a guide, there had never been the tainted quality about death, no spoilage. When he shot it, he had always been hidden in the trees or in the crags and rocks, and they brought in the meat. Bradley turned back to the trail and started up. Wait a minute. Elliot took out his canteen, poured water over his hand, and wiped his face. I want to watch. Oh, yes, Bradley said. Don't you? No. Bradley went on a short distance, then stopped again. You have the work to do. Elliot felt the anger rise. You do some of it, he shouted. That will be a change. Get the hide cleaned up. He had not wanted to argue, but that was always the first rule when you were in business. Bradley had been good for what they had told him to do in New York. He knew the country and how to avoid the wardens, but he was too cautious, too silent. Elliot considered whether he should go back anyway. Finally, he said, I won't be long. Bradley went on without a word. Elliot watched his awkward climbing to the crest of the hill, then he disappeared beyond the brown, dusty curve. Elliot felt a vague sense of disquiet being alone. Not that there was any particular danger. He had the rifle. He could not get lost. But he had never been upon a such strange, immense expanse of land before. He did not like the emptiness of it. He turned his attention quickly back downward toward the plain. The land seemed to darken, moving with the shadows of the birds. Elliot tried to count, but already there were too many. They soared in now from every direction. The first of them circled in a close, tight ring to test for danger and began to come down. It was the silence which began to get to him. He wondered how these scavengers communicated. Was it by eyesight alone or by the scent of death? Did one vulture spot the carcass in his honing in on it, alert the rest of them to the discovery? There was no shade. The whole plain stretched out before him in the broad bands of browns and yellows. Even the trees were dust-covered and hard, and a hard, dry green. A couple of vultures dropped to the ground next to the carcass, their huge wings easing them down quietly. The first of the birds that touched the ground nearly made him sick. After the first, the others came more rapidly. They no longer made the short circles, but rather came sweeping in directly in a dive. The first bird went into the carcass to the anus, the softest part. The great hooked beaks tore into the bowels and even ripped out the intestines which curled from the body like a tight white hose. Other birds fought for pieces. There was simply not enough space in the carcass for so many. But with the hide taken, it was easier. Within a few minutes, the birds had shredded the flesh. Some small fights were constant, and even small bits of meat were prizes which had to be won again and again. Elliot felt all of this run through him, settle in upon his mind in the slowly building terror. This body was disintegrating before his eyes, pulled apart and consumed. What frightened him was the feeling of being dead and not knowing what was happening to your flesh. He imagined what he knew impossible, being dead and still sensing the sharp jabs of beaks into his skin. He lay there unmoving beneath the plague. Then all at once he could not stand the sensation any longer. He pointed the rifle toward the carcass and fired. The vultures exploded into the air like a mass of black paper. He saw right away that he had hit one of them and wounded it. It ran in circles, fluttering a huge extended wing. The rest did not move high or very far. Several went into the low dead limbs of a nearby snag. Some simply raised themselves into the air like a man standing up to rest from bending over and then settled back down again. Elliot wondered. Vultures. He aimed this time carefully and fired again. The sun did not let up, even though the light was easing. Sweat kept coming. He was entranced, shocked. The vultures hissed and struggled over the dead bird just as they continued to do over the zebra carcass, mindless of the threat that he wielded. He fired another shot into the air above them, but the vultures did not scatter. Their giant wings flapping for leverage, they continued to pull at the body. He stood up in panic. Something in him had built up and exploded at the rifle and ran forward, screaming. There was a sudden lull, and the vultures seemed to hesitate for a moment, as if alert to some possible new danger. Elliot let his weight carry him down the slope toward the gully. He waved his arms wildly and kept screaming. A few of the vultures flew up, but only when he came crashing forward from the brush to the in the gully did they seem to know he was there. He lunged forward in the heat across the dusty ground, panting and screaming in a hoarse voice. The vultures finally scattered. They ran and took off in labored flight, heavy from eating. Some of them could only bound a short distance away. Elliot reeled forward and fell onto the zebra's mutilated carcass. Slowly he came to his senses. He did not understand what had made him go crazy. Against the still, soft, bloody flesh, he could not believe he had come all the way back down that hill and was clutching the torn body the way a woman might grasp the body of a dead child. Slowly he turned, half expecting to see Bradley at the crest of the hill, heard the shots and started back. But the ridge was still the same simple curve of brown bounded by blue. The heat sifted through his clothes the way dust came through the closed windows of the rover as they drove it over the powdery roads. The vultures eyed him from perches in the trees and from the ground. He had left the rifle. He tried to figure out how to save what was left. He couldn't take any of the meat back with him, but he couldn't stay. He had to get back himself and help Bradley with the skin. And even if he'd had the rifle, it was pointless to shoot the vultures because there were hundreds, thousands. He looked carefully at what was left of the zebra. They had started a good job. The innards were gone in the neck. Where the wound had been was eaten away to the bone. The great scar on the now faceless, now eyeless face was obliterated by blood. He thought of burying the carcass, but beneath the dust was hard-baked ground. Pouring loose dirt over the blood would do nothing. He wiped his forehead, clear of dirt and sweat. Within the order of things that other animals ate, he understood that in the wild one animal fed upon another. But he could not comprehend the chaotic condition of life. He had never before seen the randomness and viciousness that one form of life brought upon another or upon its own kind. He tried to imagine how it would feel to be intelligent and defenseless. The soft, blood-red carcass beneath it distracted him. He tried to imagine then the way he most did not want to die. He considered it before, but never deeply. Now he thought of various deaths, but always came back to one. He did not want to be shot in the head while he was asleep. He would probably die in bed of old age, he thought. Someone would take him to the morgue in some big city. At least he would not be put onto the plane for dying, his body torn apart by vultures. He tried to imagine what would happen after the morgue, but nothing came to him. Would relatives come? Would there be sadness? His imagination got to funerals, cemeteries, or marble stones. He got up slowly and backed off. Blood and dust seemed to cover everything now. His clothes, his skin, the ground, the body of the zebra. The plane had turned toward dusk, a thin brown, and the sky was a bleached out blue-gray. He edged back, still watching. He had to go back and help Bradley scrape down the hide. Then they would begin to try somewhere else. Bradley knew where. They could collect enough hides to sell for a high price in the black market. They had outlets, customers. They had only to do the work. He made his way back through the brush and up the gully. When he reached his pack and the rifle, he was exhausted. The sweat had soaked through now, and although he wiped his face, he still felt the dampness in his shirt. Something had snapped in his mind, like a star shooting down from a pure black sky, some deep connection he had made between his life and his death and his place on Earth. He had been terrified. He took another shot of whiskey. In back, there was something new. Across the expanse of short brown grass and dust, a larger form emerged, barely visible against the fading colors. It moved slowly, languidly toward the dark red carcass, and beyond that larger shape were smaller animals coming in. The hyenas ran ahead. Elliot watched their weaving, cautious paths. The jackals followed resolutely. This was the way it was. When the hyenas came to the carcass, the vultures scattered again. Hyenas were not interested in them. With huge neck muscles bulging, they ripped into the meat. The jackals came on too, circling the carcass, nipping and backing away, looking for small openings to dart in and grab a bit of flesh. One hyena tore away a huge chunk of meat and carried it off toward the trees. Jackals followed. The sound had changed too. Now there was brutal barking and the cracking of bones. The leopard did not stop to test the territory of the danger. Moved into the trampled circle of ground around the carcass, snarled at the hyenas, who were replaced in strength by the cat and tested the carcass. Ellie wanted to look away from all he had seen, and yet he stayed longer to watch. He had seen the progression from the beginning to end. No, he thought, there was no end. Not yet. There was the cat still at the body, but no end. It would go on, not only the cat, but the hyenas and jackals who constantly circled, looking for their opportunities. The cat couldn't command the whole of the zebra, and now and then a hyena would rush forward and tear a bit of loose meat loose, and drag it away. And even when the feasting was over, Elliot thought, there would be the broken bones and the bits of meat still clinging, which the ants would swarm over and devour. He imagined these ants by the millions descending more terribly than the vultures had descended, onto the last tufts of hair and meat. As in the morgue, there would be no maggots here. Bradley had not come back. He would be sitting in the rover now, waiting. Elliot had nearly the whole 2 miles to go, and suddenly he struck upon something else and wondered why he had not thought of it before. He could have the cat's skin. That was the reason they had come. A leopard's hide would fit more than a zebra. He smiled at the idea of using one animal's carcass as bait for another and wondered whether it would work every time. Perhaps it was only a matter of waiting until all the scavengers came. So he raised his rifle again and looked at the leopard through the hazy scope. He centered the crosshairs and focused, the black green closing out all the rest of the plane. Thank you all for coming.